From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. An author and journalist who coined the phrase nature deficit disorder has spent recent years defining the term. Richard Louv is the author of Last Child in the Woods and The Nature Principle, which investigate why people need a better connection with nature. This interview first played earlier this year when Louv visited and spoke at Viterbo University. I asked him when he realized there was such a thing as nature deficit disorder in society.
You know, as I describe in both books, I had a boyhood that had a lot of time in nature, and I was aware very early that it was that there was more there than it seemed, that it did something for me that I couldn't explain. In the late 1980s, to research a book called Childhood's Future, which was published in 1990 by Houghton Mifflin, I interviewed about 3,000 children and parents all over the country in groups, in classrooms and in living rooms. Came back with 10,000 pages of transcripts. It's no way to do a book, by the way. way too much work. But what I was doing is I was listening to families to find out what it was that had changed so radically and how they were dealing with that. At that time, the old rule book had been thrown out in terms of parenting, lots of parenting questions, et cetera, because women had gone to work, et cetera, et cetera, and no rule book had been written new. So I was looking for the repeating theme. So what I would do is go into these groups and classrooms, and I would let them tell me what they wanted to talk about. And the themes that repeated themselves became the chapters. And one of those themes, to my surprise, was that parents were very puzzled by this, what they felt was some kind of profound change in the relationship between children and nature. The kids weren't going outside very much, as they had when they were kids, these parents. Now, since then, it's accelerated. And at that time, in the late 1980s, there were very few studies of this. There were very few people asking questions about it. Over the years after that, the decade after that, a lot of research came forth. And at that point, it was no longer anecdotal evidence. My chapter in that book had been picked up by Utney Reader and Sierra Club magazine. But at that time, it was just anecdotal. Now we've got a lot of evidence, both with the gap, but also, and to me more interesting, we've got evidence of how great nature is, how essential it is for healthy human development, whether you're a kid or an adult.
And I'm wondering how much of a role your own family played in you coming to that conclusion. You write a lot about adventures that you have in nature with your wife and with your son. And at the beginning of The Last Child in the Woods, you mention a story when I think your son asks you, why was your childhood so much more fun than mine?
Yeah, that was a shocker. I thought he was having a great time. He was having a great time as a kid, but like all the other kids, he was spending a lot of time in electronics and didn't have the kind of freedom that I did. That was the main difference, is that I really was a free-range kid. I mean, I was in the woods with my dog. There really weren't as many constraints. Today, some of the things that I did, my parents would have been accused of neglect, of child neglect, unfortunately, because I think I had a great childhood. I had really the freedom to develop, to notice, to sense, to hear, to see on my own. Much of that was in nature.
And where did you grow up?
Outside of Kansas City, in the suburban edge of Kansas City. And I could go out my back door of our little house through the yard and the hedge and then on into the cornfield where my underground fort was, and then on from there all into the woods and the fields that seemed to go on forever. I had an intense sense of ownership of those woods. Those were my woods. They're in my heart then, and they're in my heart now. I sometimes go to those woods in my heart, and I find something that I don't find anywhere else. I had such a sense of intense ownership of those woods that I think as an eight-year-old I pulled out hundreds of survey stakes that I knew had something to do with the bulldozers that were taking out other woods. That sense of ownership of belonging somewhere and having that place not only belong to you in a metaphorical sense, but having it own you. And that sense, I think, is you know, that place in the heart where nature resides, those woods reside, for me, the question for me is, will future generations have that place in their heart to go to?
And that probably goes along with your other idea that you want people to live in nature, not with it. Can you explain that?
There's a chapter near the end of The Nature Principle where I talk about the right to a walk in the woods. I actually think that this is a human right, or should be considered that, this positive connection to the natural world, because if it is as fundamental to our humanity as many of us believe it is, in terms of our health, our psychological health, our physical health, our spiritual health, then anything that is fundamental to our humanity, a human being should have a right to. When I was researching that chapter, which originally was a piece in Orion magazine, I had noticed that I would ask people that question, do adults have a right to a walk in the woods? It would make some of my friends who were environmentalists very nervous. They didn't like that question, and it surprised me, their reaction. And, you know, over time, there's some obvious reasons for that. You know, great, all we need is another reason to sue each other. They were thinking of it in a legalistic way. I wasn't. But it still made them nervous. And over time, I realized that many environmentalists, conservationists, whatever, not all, but many of them have this feeling underneath that is seldom said out loud, that humans don't deserve nature.
And why is that?
Because we're destroying it at such a fast rate. Why should we have a right to anything that we are destroying at such a fast rate? Now, I understand that. I understand how they feel. I feel that way in some days. But the problem is that if we distance ourselves from nature by saying that, I mean, I've heard from environmentalists who don't like what I'm saying because they don't think anybody should be in the woods, kids or adults, or the deserts or wherever. But as I thought about this, I realized how similar it was that reaction was to people on the other end of the political, cultural spectrum. Conservative religious folks, some, not all, who see nature as, at best, a stepping stone to the real paradise. And they really don't see its value. They see it there to be dominated, the whole dominion attitude toward nature. What I concluded is that there's a strange similarity between some of my environmental friends and some of the religious right, including some of my friends who are on the religious right. Both of them see nature as the other, as separate from human beings. I don't think we're going to do much about protecting nature until we stop thinking about it as the other. And this has to do with where we live, work, live, and play. We need nature all around us, all the time. It's not an abstraction. It's not something we have to drive or should have to drive 2 hours to get to. It should be immersed. We should be immersed in it all the time. And I think if we do that, we will see great benefits to our health and well-being.
And is it as simple as taking a walk after dinner, planting an herb garden, you know, putting a plant on your desk? Or is it much more than that?
Well, it can be as simple as that. And as time has gone by, and I've become more sensitized myself to really experiencing nature in those small ways. When I travel, I always try to escape the hotel. I haven't done it here yet. I'm going to go down to the river tonight, I hope. And I go find nature, and I take pictures of it with my iPhone and send them to my wife because it settles me, it calms me, et cetera. So there's even in the densest of urban cities, I'll find nature somewhere. So that's true. But I think if we begin to think about that in a more complex way, an example is a couple weekends ago, my wife and I were kind of practicing what I preach, which is we were replanting our yard with native species or parts of our yard with native species, native plants, in order to bring back butterfly migration routes. And there's all kinds of benefits if you plant native species in your yards and replace some of that Kentucky bluegrass. There's even a theory about that if we really want to bring back the biodiversity we need or preserve what we need, conservation alone isn't enough. We've now got to start creating nature. That's one of the themes in the Nature Principle, including in our backyards. If we converted all of our backyards to native species, we would see a big jump in biodiversity. Anyhow, we were planting these plants, these native plants, and my wife had this idea. She said, you know, what if this holiday season, instead of taking little bottles of jam around to the neighbors, what if I took plants around the little plant to each neighbor's? That would be a native plant, and then that would attract butterflies. And then we could declare our neighborhood a butterfly zone. I was talking to an expert on this who's written a great book called Bringing Nature Home, who said that fits right into his idea, which is a homegrown national park. What if your yard and my yard and their yard and the yard down the street were connected almost as a wildlife corridor through a city, by planting native species, by encouraging wildlife, all through a city? What if that were connected to other cities? What if that were connected nationwide? What if we had in our mind the creation of a homegrown national park, starting with our own backyards? I think it's that kind of thinking that could be part of what I call and what I describe in the Nature Principle as a new nature movement that would go beyond environmentalism as we know it and would go beyond even sustainability as we know it.
And you're listening to Newsmakers. My guest today is Richard Louvre. His latest book is The Nature Principle, Human Restoration and the End of Nature Deficit Disorder. I want to go back to something you said a couple minutes ago. You said, tonight you hope to go down by the river and take a picture on your iPhone and send it to your wife. So you have that juxtaposition of nature at its finest and then also modern technology at its finest. Mm-hmm. And that's something else you touch in the book is that you say there has to be a balance between nature and technology.
Well, first, I'm not anti-tech, and I love my iPhone too much. You know, what I'm describing is not the kind of back-to-the-land movement that was popular in the 60s and early 70s. It's a different kind of approach to nature. In the Nature Principle, I talk about what I call the hybrid mind. When you look at the benefits of nature exposure to nature, time in nature, to our ability to learn, I mean, the studies really are pretty amazing in terms of its increase in mental acuity, increase in creativity, increase in productivity. We seem to be able to put the dots, to connect the dots in our thinking, which has to do with creativity, with seeing a whole picture when we spend more time out in nature. I mean, studies have been done of people hiking. When they get back from the hike, they can actually proofread better than when they left. That there seems to be these immediate benefits to our mind, to our ability to think and see patterns. The best way for me to describe the hybrid mind is, and by the way, the full use of the senses, that's a big part of this. We have all these senses we don't use every day that we could be using if we weren't so truncated in terms of our experience by looking at a screen all day. In any case, the best explanation is I met a guy who teaches people how to become the pilots of cruise ships. And he said he gets two kinds of students. One kind grew up indoors on couches, playing video games, on computers, et cetera. He says, you know, those students have a great talent that I really need. They're really terrific at the electronics of the ship, and I need that. He said the second kind of student, a student that grew up mainly outdoors, hunting and fishing and hiking, whatever it was, on a farm, whatever, those students also have a great talent. They actually know where the ship is. They can tell where it is.
Now, because their senses have been trained to.
That's right. He wasn't being flippant. He was actually saying that they had more of a spatial sense of what was around them. And when you look at the studies of the senses, the people who study, scientists who study the human senses, they no longer talk about five senses. They talk about as many as 30. And everything from echolocation, which bats use. Human beings can do that, too. People who have lost their sight are now being trained, some of them, to use echolocation. But there's a whole cluster of senses about where we are in space, where we are in a room, where we are. So he was actually being pretty literal. So his summation was his ideal student would be a student who had both sets of abilities, both the ability on the electronics, but also the ability that nature gives us in terms of our thinking and our senses.
Here in La Crosse, we're surrounded by a few different rivers. We're surrounded by the bluffs on another side. I mean, the opportunities to be in the outdoors and to be within nature is pretty easy, but there are still many people who have lived in this town their whole lives or children who are growing up here who either don't take the time to spend time with nature or have never really thought about it. And I've talked with some people who find it almost intimidating. How do you communicate to those people that it is worth their time?
San Diego, where I'm from, there's a study of inner city kids that found that 95% of them had never been in a boat. 90% of them had never learned how to swim. And 36%, I believe, had never been to the ocean. It's 20 minutes away or less. So this is not that uncommon for this kind of disconnection. In terms of what's in it for them, and one of the reasons I wrote The Nature Principles, this is not just about kids. This is about adults, too. The Nature Principles more about adults. The Last Child in the Woods is obviously more about kids. But we all have what I call nature deficit disorder, which is not a known medical term, but it's a way to talk about this thing. When you begin to learn about the stress reduction that just a little bit of nature gives us, when you begin to learn about this as an alternative or at least an addition to antidepressants, when you begin to learn that attention deficit disorder, which is not only a factor for children but for adults too, that the symptoms of that can be greatly reduced with just a little bit of time in nature. That's not to replace, you know, pharmaceuticals, which some people probably need. But when you begin to learn the physical benefits of it, there are studies that have shown that compared people on a treadmill in a gym compared to people who do green exercise, go for a hike, a garden, both groups expending the exact same amount of calories, people on the treadmill and the people exercising outside. Same amount of energy, same amount of calories. People on the treadmill, they get healthier. Blood pressure gets better, the psychological health gets better, but the people who do it outdoors expending the same amount of calories get even better. There's a margin of improvement there we don't understand.
This morning you spoke with a group of middle school and high school students from La Crosse. How do you get the message to them that being out in nature can be beneficial, especially if you're speaking in an auditorium and not taking them out on a hike or anything like that?
One of the things that I noticed early on, right after Last Child came out, I was asked to speak at a high school near where I live, and I didn't want to do it. I was grumpy and home from a trip and didn't want to. Then I started feeling guilty because I wrote this book. It was my
own
community.
You needed nature time.
Yeah, well, I needed to go talk to these people in my own community. So I went, and there were, I expected 20 kids, high school kids, and there were 200 of them. They'd been given extra credit. And I talked for about an hour, and you could have heard a pin drop. And it was not because I'm a great speaker. I'm not. It was something else. I talked about two things. I talked about the fact that their health and the full use of their senses, their ability to feel fully alive, is directly connected to how much time they spend in nature and can be greatly increased by how much time they spend in nature. The second thing I talked about is because of climate change, global warming, whatever we want to call it, because of that and these other huge environmental problems we do face, everything in the next 40 years must change. We need new kinds of agriculture, already beginning, new kinds of energy, already beginning, new kinds of cities, new kinds of urban design, new kinds of architecture. It's already beginning with what's called biophilic design. Now, to any self, any creative 16-year-old, that's good news. Everything else changed. We actually need a new civilization now. We need one in which nature is woven into our everyday lives. We need to increase the biodiversity. We can do that and greatly improve the quality of our lives in the kinds of houses we live in, the kinds of yards we have, the kind of cities, neighborhoods, etc. Everything must change. When the kids left, I turned to the biology teacher who'd invited me and said, what was that all about? Why were they paying so much attention? I was surprised. He said, easy answer, Rich. You said something hopeful about the future, the environment. They never hear that. So that is part of the reason that I wrote the second book, The Nature Principle, because one of the things I've often said is that Martin Luther King said and demonstrated in many ways that any culture, any movement, any culture will fail if it cannot paint a picture of a world that people will want to go to. We've been failing at that. So the nature principle is within my great limitations, is my effort to answer that question. What would that culture, what would that civilization be like to live in if we had nature in our lives all the time?
And what do you think it would be like?
You know, it's a student this morning asked me that question. Well, describe that world. And, you know, I'm still working on that, on a condensed version. I had to write a whole book. It's a 320-page yeah, right. book. But I said, well, that's a great question. She said, what would that look like? I said, you know, we would live in cities where nature, nearby nature, would be all around us. We would work in workplaces that we would be more productive, and sick time would go down, and turnover would get better, because in these biophilic design in these workplaces, that's the result. Studies are showing that. We would live in homes and neighborhoods that would be connected with wildlife corridors. We would be in schools in which they stopped canceling recess. They stopped canceling field trips, and they started creating natural play spaces instead of these blank, empty asphalt areas. We, in the countryside, we would see the return of small towns across the Great Plains, but in a new way, using technology, but raising native crops, raising edible prairie, for instance, which is being worked on by folks to figure out how to do that. We would have wildlife in our cities. We would have what I call in the book human nature social capital, which is, you know, why is it we only talk about humans when we talk about social capital? Why aren't we talking about all those other species? You know, we would have a sense of kinship every day of our lives with other species who are all around us and enriching our lives. They would be part of our lives and we would be part of theirs. I think all of this and much more is very much within our reach, and we can start doing it tomorrow.
Richard Louv is a journalist and author of the books Last Child in the Woods and The Nature Principle. They explore the need for humans to get back in touch with nature. He was at Viterbo University recently on behalf of the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCullum. Our production team includes Steve Roysom, John Gatto, Mary Meehan Stroob, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. To hear archives of this or other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/lacrosse. In addition to Newsmakers, you'll find archived reports and special series produced by the La Crosse News Bureau. And if you'd like to comment on this week's Newsmakers or have a suggestion for future shows, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/lacrosse. Newsmakers is also now on Facebook. Updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more. Follow us at WPR Newsmakers on Facebook.